Welcome everyone. For those of you who don't know, I'm Anthony Asher, we'll be chairing the meeting, trying to keep us polite and on track, but which is always polite. I'm beginning to think that the attendance is inversely proportional to the controversy, potential controversy, but we'll see how we go on that one. So let's start. Cameron will introduce with a 5-minute talk, and the objective of this is to generate discussion. So we'll sort of work through some of the issues in the papers. I'll try and keep us more or less on one subject at a time, if you would help by just addressing the topic at hand, and then we'll get round to, there'll be plenty of time to get round to any questions that you have. Later, so be relaxed about that. We should have, thus we go on for 2 if necessary, although we have finished about 1:45 both times, previous times. The idea is interchange of ideas and a chance to express yourself and listen to others. So, Cameron.
Yeah. Okay. So I suppose, just in terms of highlighting the subject area, it's something that particularly in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, has sort of sparked quite a lot of public debate. In the aftermath of that state of affairs, you actually had quite a few major corporations be bailed out of the public purse, and at the same time, Merrill Lynch stands out as one of them. You had a lot of bonuses actually paid out using taxpayer funds. And so that stoked a lot of controversy at the time. And so that's just the starting point for why this particular subject emerges as something of a touching point at the moment. And I suppose just in terms of what I want to go through today, and just to give you a brief summary of some of the more recent papers, one piece you had published late last year by a chap who works at GMO, James Montier, was looking at shareholder value maximisation and making the rather large claim that it was the world's dumbest idea. And essentially, while that sounded controversial, he did try to make quite a few attempts to illustrate why that's the case. And he talks about it not just from the perspective of shareholders and whether or not companies pursuing this as an objective actually generates better returns. And it goes to some lengths to try and illustrate that with a few examples, IBM and Johnson & Johnson as a case in point, but also trying to think about the broader consequences for society as a whole. So, and this is an interesting one, and some of you might disagree with the stance on this point, and he might be conflating a few different ideas, but it's essentially this notion that as companies have become more and more focused on very short-term thinking, and as they become more and more focused on a purely profit prism, it's leading to some consequences at an aggregate level that are actually quite damaging for economies as a whole. And some of those, just to quickly touch on them, are rising inequality, where you're seeing the share that employees, workers, and that the share of national income they're getting has been declining for the past few decades. And a second related aspect is also just the decline in business investment. One thing that's been quite notable in a lot of Western countries, and he uses the US as a case in point, but you also see it in Australia, it's just the decline in proportion of investment as a proportion of GDP. I mean, you've got the mining boom, so if you strip that out, it's something you do notice in the Australian context as well. And just to briefly move on to highlight some of the other aspects, you also had Cliff Asness, who's a notable hedge fund manager, come out in defence of the doctrine and argue it was more an issue of people, when they construct incentives for executives and the like, not being able to think on a long enough time horizon in terms of how we structure options for corporate executives and the like. And then finally, we had a speech actually from the Bank of International Settlements, which actually traces the origins on this idea, and was asking some pointed questions about whether or not it is still the case that the corporation in its current rendition and shareholder value maximisation in its current form is actually the right model to go forward with the 21st century. And so in the context of today's discussion, what I'm hoping to touch on is just some people's thoughts on the idea of this as a policy to begin with. A few of you here, I've noticed, work for some of the major listed companies in the country, and I'd be just curious to see how much of it is actually a fresh concept in your mind. And also, just more broadly, do you think that there is a bit of that failure at an aggregate level when we actually think about if every single company is pursuing this as an objective, when we actually sum all of those up, is the outcome we're getting at the aggregate really ideal for us as an economy?
Thanks, Cameron. So this is Cameron's idea of the topic, so this is why he's talking.
So in terms of why it's an interesting subject, I've got a very broad range of interests, particularly in public policy, and it's something that I think is an area that people like to talk a lot about. And one thing that people don't like to do is actually just try and... Numbers are a fickle thing, but I think even just some really rudimentary analysis and the like, and really thinking about how you actually make a robust case in public policy is something I'm quite passionate about. And this is a subject area where I think a lot of benefit could be drawn about people just taking a step back and looking at the case either side, and rather than delving into emotional appeals, which is often what a lot of public policy debates end up as, trying to take a step back and looking at it, and it's just something that I think is quite interesting.
Sorry to butt in so quickly, but I just wanted to say, it seems to me that these days we've got into a lot more selling messages and all that sort of stuff. So, all these companies are still aiming to maximise their profits, but basically it's a conglomeration of people gaming the system and trying to do what they want to do, which you've kind of alluded to. So it's a bit of a broad statement to say that all the companies are out there trying to maximise their profits, when really what's going on underneath may not be that all the companies are out there trying to maximise their profits. There's CEOs who want to do a takeover or something and get caught up in the emotion of it and leave a legacy and all that sort of stuff. There's individuals, Barry's Bend or wherever, who won't go, well, geez, I'm in trouble now, but maybe I can trade my way out of it. I think there is an awful lot going on underneath and perhaps it sort of partly goes towards that kind of difference in one interpretation of it being the dumbest idea in the world, and another interpretation saying, well, hold on, is that really the idea of maximising shareholder wealth, or is it something else that's going on that's pretty dumb?
I think what you've alluded to there, it's certainly a real concern. I mean, we like to think that we have this view of company management and that as this almost robotic soldiers that are there to execute the wishes of shareholders and to maximise the returns. And that people are human, and I think empire building and the other things you pointed out are very real concerns. But I think just for the purpose of this discussion, I think it's right to point to those things, but what we're trying to focus here is just more on an overall perspective. And I think what you're saying is perfectly fair. You do see quite a few cases where company is a CEO's baby, for lack of a better phrase, then the consequences of that when they play out can be quite damaging for the shareholders that get taken along for the ride.
There's an interesting statistic, sorry, do you want to...
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this interesting statistic in the UK where the CEO salaries of the top 100 companies is 183 times that of the average UK worker. We're just trying to work out what the current figure is for Australia at the moment. I mean, I don't know if I should disclose the cost of conflict of interest here, but Aon Hewitt currently looks after the Financial Institutions Remuneration Group of Australia, so that covers pretty much all the firms we all work for and everybody else. But I guess what we see is increased focus on pay and performance, that correlation. In the past, it's been, let's just say, loose in some organisations, and there's a few obvious things where if you actually look at performance in organisations, more senior individuals, more senior roles and executives are more likely to have better performance. They either rate themselves higher or they're rated higher. So there's obviously something going on a little bit around that. But certainly our view is also that there's increased focus on areas like risk culture, and a key driver of risk culture is obviously decision-making behaviours, and what drives them quite obviously is how do incentive structures work or don't work. So firms are very significantly looking at that correlation between incentives, performance, and then paying for performance.
I suppose.
Yeah, there was a, in your opening comments, there was a very strong theme of short-termism. And that's actually something that's received commentary in the press in the last few weeks. And I noted that the executives very rapidly passed that parcel to the analysts and said that they're to blame for that, which I think raises an interesting question. I do recall that when I worked for a corporation, I got into a certain amount of trouble in this area myself, because I'd be told things like, well, you can't do that as an actuary because the analysts won't understand what you're doing. And with the obvious corollary that the share price will be affected. Now, the simple-minded viewpoint, and in describing it as simple-minded, I'm not saying that it's wrong, the simple-minded viewpoint is that the analysts are there representing the great unwashed. They are the intermediaries interpreting information, and that any preferences they have simply reflect the preferences of society at large. So if they're to blame, then society is to blame. And that raises the question of whether that line of reasoning is correct. Are they representing society? And if not, how does that come about? I mean, you would reason that if it's not the case, then that represents a market niche that someone can move into and represent society's wishes more accurately. So what are the questions arising from this? So I guess the questions are, do you think that the CEOs are correct and the analysts are to blame? And if you do, you think that means society is to blame? And if so, why would that be?
I'll just quickly take it. I think it's a bit of a half and half in some respects. I do think the analysts have a certain focus on particular industry segments and the like that they do cover. And I think we also have to acknowledge that the analyst game has changed slightly. I mean, this is probably more pronounced in the US, is my understanding. But even over here, you have some analysts spread across multitude of companies, and the amount of analysts covering a particular segment like insurance or some other segment of the market has shrunk considerably. And so in that sense, you're probably not going to get as in-depth a look at certain organisations as you might have enjoyed in the past. But I think the other aspect of it is probably CEOs, this is more, you see this brought up in a number of the consultant firms. I think PwC was a big mention about just the, and Deloitte as well actually, about just the unwillingness of Australian companies to really reinvest, and instead you just see quite sizable payouts to shareholders and without a corresponding attempt to really try and grow the business organically. And I think that's something where you don't typically see a lot of, for lack of a better term, bravery or vision really being put out by that many organisations these days, in the sense that we're going to be, this is our vision, this is our strategy for the future, and articulating that proposition and actually explaining it to analysts. It's, in that sense, a lot of the Australian businesses are probably a bit guilty of being conservative. And the last point to that as well is just, and this is related as well, the way companies evaluate a lot of projects these days. The RBA came out with a survey around June this year where it was looking at how companies actually evaluate projects and investments, and it found that they were very much interest rate insensitive, and they were quite, this was an overall picture, but they had very elevated returns on capital that they were expecting, and there wasn't really that trade-off or really look at the current environment and actually saying, okay, this is the state of play. I'm probably going to have to accept a lower rate of return, but I can still get something. And so that's also an interesting dynamic when companies are trying to make these decisions as well. A lot of their processes at the moment hasn't actually changed for quite some time. At least that's what the RBA's analysis found.
Yes. Some of the things that you mentioned there, I mean, things in relation to corporate vision, for example, seem to me to be part of the cultural cringe, really. An example would be, I saw a survey sometime in the last two or three weeks of the number of major corporations that defined in some way, sort of above some threshold, the proportion of major corporations who were collaborating with the academic sector. Top of the list was Finland, they were 47% or something. Quite high on the list, surprisingly, was the UK, that was somewhere around 30%, and Australia was around 3%. The tentative explanation given there was that that a lot of the large Australian companies are outposts of larger international companies, and therefore it's not their role to be conducting leading research, but that gap between 30 and 3 is very, very large, and it suggests that there might be something else at work there, and that something else, you guess, might be cultural.
So that's probably the worst performing economy in the world in the world for.
I've challenged about nearly everything you've said, because I don't know you've got any scientific evidence other than those anecdotal, but all short term, and therefore it's bad. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I've seen too many studies that actually prove that. Has anybody got studies? Like, everyone likes to talk about it, raw short term, and focus on these things, but I'm not, has anyone actually proved that actually doesn't get you the best result?
We did some conjoined analysis on what senior executives value in terms of
total reward. I don't care what they value, I'm asking about, does it give you a bad result? Then
you've got to work out what a good result is.
Yeah.
But if we say we've got a problem, you have to measure and find.
But I think that's just one interesting, you talk about short term, and that's one interesting component of a few, but the one in particular I'd pull out was that most chief executives, the one thing that came up the most, was the word you used earlier, was legacy. Most chief executives will trade a fair amount of things for legacy. That really matters.
which is interesting if they're not going for long-term projects. But
well, maybe there's a risk of your legacy if you get your project wrong.
I'm not saying that everyone's perfect. I'm just asking a question.
Sure.
There's a statement made a lot. There's also the statement made that there's increasing inequality. But we always measure equality based on historic look at dollar amounts. No one ever pays attention to what a dollar buys you now in a world of absolute huge scale mass production global stuff, and what the cost of bespoke stuff is. What I mean by that is, you can go and buy a Hyundai little Getz car and it costs you $12,000 these days. If you want something that's twice as good, you don't pay $24,000 for it. You pay $67,000. If you want something that's twice as good as that, you're in the real bespoke territory, and it's $1.5 million Ferrari or something. I'm not saying that this is all right, but I mean, no one allows for, what we talk about these days with middle class welfare and all the tax effects and freebies in society. Like, no one ever does that. They just say, oh, top salary over median salary 20 years ago was X, and now it's 2X, and this is inequality and disaster. And I go, well, objectively, I don't even know whether it's true or not. I'm not saying it's not true, but I'm not arguing that there is an increase in quality. I go, actually, I don't really know. I just look now at the average person, that huge amounts of stuff that they can have because of mass production is huge compared to 20 or 30 years ago. A rich person 30 years ago wouldn't have the stuff that the average person has now. I actually find that difficult. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that. The other thing I think is there's a lot of talk about how much companies invest and don't invest. And I don't know how you actually assess that, because 30 years ago, and you see these analyses on Tobin's Q and how the US is all overvalued. And the funny thing I note is, when the departure happened? Mid-80s. What happened in the mid-80s? The rise of tertiary industries, technology and all the rest of it. And if you're a business like mine, we spent a pile of money last year on internal resources, on product development, systems and all the rest of it. None of that's on our balance sheet. It all goes straight through expenses because accounting standards don't allow you to capitalise it. If I was buying a whole bunch of widget makers, if I was a secondary industry, I would have bought these machines, they'd be on my balance sheet, they'd be depreciated, and you'd be able to add it all up and go, oh, look how much they invested. You can't see it on an IT company. In fact, go and look at Google or Facebook's accounts. The biggest thing, the biggest depreciable assets they've got on their balance sheet, their investments, is their servers for their server farms. There's nothing in there from the amount that they're investing every day in their IT. So, you have to be really careful about some of these assumptions, that as you move from primary, secondary industry into tertiary, quaternary, and all these other sectors, what investment even looks like, it's not easy to measure anymore. And I just find it quite interesting that Tobin's Q graph just departs from, let's say, about 85, and it just goes like that, and you go, is that true, or is it just accounting and historic reporting just doesn't actually capture the stuff? The amount that you're investing in your own intellectual IP in your business is just not there.
But there's a question, Greg. Have you guys got a... Would you have a balance sheet item for your IT? Would it be worthwhile?
No, if you read our financial statements, we spent $8 million last year on a whole platform, new product, everything fresh to market. I think about $3 million of that got capitalised because it was external consultants that we could trace. The rest of it was people that were on the payroll that were invested in building all the stuff. None of that gets capitalised. It just went straight to the bottom line. So we've made public statements that our profit was down $3.5 million after tax because of that. But it's an expense. So I don't know how you measure it.
Well, it's a sort of embedded value, isn't it?
It's a type of
embedded value. It is an interesting thing for actors to calculate.
Yeah. Well, it is. I'm just saying, I don't know how you measure that stuff these days and what investment looks like. And in the information world, where a lot of it is around intellectual property is the value and the stuff that you're building. Computer code, which isn't a machine, is not on your balance sheet, it's not a masthead, it's not a thing you bought. So, anyway,
it might be of interest to your stakeholders.
It is, but we disclose it. I'm saying you can't go along and add up all company balance sheets
and find all the plant and equipment, add it all up and say, ah, that's the current depreciated book value. So Tobit's Q, that's sort of what it does. You just get all the balance sheets, add them up and go, market value over replacement cost, happy day, and you go, well, it's because that thing's getting smaller and the hardware is getting cheaper and cheaper as well. It's not the thing you're investing in. And I suppose the question is, if it's not a secondary industry, does it not matter? Or are you only worried about stuff? So,
anyone want to respond to some of those questions?
I mean, I know the big healthcare companies that we know of, like the CSLs and the Cochrane's and the ResMeds, these all came from university type R&D backgrounds. As far as I know, they are still collaborating with the universities to continue developing the IP. It may not turn the dial when you look at it at a national level, but it's certainly significant to some of these companies. And I guess the high hurdle rates for investment. The problem is we've gone through this capex boom, which has mainly been related to China and the mining boom, but suddenly all these companies that, I mean, look at BHP, right? They're paying a dividend that's more than what they earned last year because they've got nothing else to prop up their share price. Because all the capex they spent on was predicated on high prices for commodities, which have halved or more since they push the start button on these projects. So it's difficult. I think back to Greg's point that the investment that's being made in IT is still going on. The banks, for example, are all spending decent amounts of money at least on IT just to catch up with CBA. But I think, at least from my observation of proxy voting, AGM seasons, where more and more the great unwash is actually represented by your superannuation fund. And I think there's at least $2 trillion worth of financial assets held by most of these funds, and that's more than the Australian stock market, the size of the Australian stock market. So these guys are paying more and more attention to what managements pay themselves. But I do think there is a problem in that the measurement time frames are too short. But it is getting longer, but I still find companies that pay their CEOs on the basis of 3-year share price performance versus their peers, and that's it. There are no other measures of how well this guy has done or not. There may be internal measures, but the external measures to shareholders are very simplistic and far too short. That may be something that you could give us a view on. But a market cycle surely must be more than 3 years.
Just a question on what you were saying, Alan. Have the super funds started to become a bit more activist in their approach?
It seems like it, yeah.
Okay. Because I know in the US there was one case where a fund advisor, DFA, which manages quite a sizable amount of assets, has started to become a lot more interventionist in how they approach certain companies and the policies they make. And it was just something I'm aware of. It's been a criticism of your institutional investors that they've essentially been rubber stamping a lot of the CEO and executive remuneration in past years.
They have, but there's, at least in the last year or so, there has been this move to divestment. So I think some of the super funds sold their shares in Transfield recently. Because of alleged human rights abuses up at Nauru and Manus Island. And I think last year, the ANU, I think the superannuation fund, divested from a mining company, and they copped a lot of flak for that. It may be just good timing that they sold at a good price, who knows, but
There's also increased independent directorships going on. So, I mean, I think you're exactly on the money. I mean, there's a degree of lack of activism because of them being. It's not individual shares, is it? It's sort of owned by institutional investors. But that, I think that's slowly changing. What's interesting with super funds is actually that they're looking at, if you talk about what's their biggest strategy, it's always about members, but none of their pay structures in the past were based on short-term profits like everybody else. So they're beginning to move towards looking at member outcomes for award structures. Again, tricky to do because the outcomes for the people you're implementing today might not be retiring for 40 years, but it still shows better willing to match corporate performance to outcomes in society.
So you're talking about industry funds or across the board?
Across the board. You mean this has started, it started actually in the advice industry with Trowbridge at looking how incentives were going to change there, but equally super funds are looking at that issue around, well, the most important thing for us in the long term is member outcomes and retirement outcomes, but if you look at how we reward our performance, that word doesn't appear anywhere, so they're beginning to see how that might work. But it's hard. It's not simple.
People are going to say something about 3 years?
I don't know how long is a long term. 3 years is about the end of my limit. I don't have illusion of control of beliefs. I'm actually going to influence my business or not possibly you 3 years down the track. I don't know. Ask the average person, if I was going to punt your salary, half your salary for a year or two, you're happy just to accept the same number? No. I want about twice as much. I don't know. I know the objective, but I find it actually quite hard to give an average person, or even if you're an executive, you know, punting your salary 3 years down the track for a possible maybe and not a blow up with the board because you disagree with them and all the rest of it. How you go that time? 3 years is a long time. It's a long time in business.
There's also a lot that can happen outside of your control, right? So your share price can tank, even though you've done a great job, and vice versa, right? You could go into a massive boom, your share price could double, and you hit all your options. You could have done a crap job. So, you know, I challenge the idea that your share price actually reflects the value of your company in the long run anyway, because the market's so noisy. So taking the next step to link that to remuneration just seems a bit absurd.
Wouldn't that be generally agreed? I mean, that's like the point of the target to size. I think that the one criticism is that, you know, I think everyone's, it seems as though there's agreement, what is the second person in? Aston's, he sort of agrees that with you, because it doesn't, well, presumably, standard remuneration theory now says tying your remuneration to the share price is not a good idea.
You want to be linking to something where if you're making money, you can give more. I mean, you don't want to be giving loads out if you're not making any money, of course. But yeah, I think everybody's in agreement around longer term views and sort of what design. It's not something I personally designed, but it's called gates. You mean just different gates that have to be filled before payments get made.
So,
mm-hmm.
So
the
question arises from your comments on. It's your remuneration is 3 years the outside limit of your remuneration. If the company has to engage in projects that are going to take longer than 3 years, is then remuneration the wrong way of rewarding the company?
Companies that are taking projects that are more than 3 years in the current world.
I think
world of disruption and everything, I have 3 years to lock down.
I think that's the question really. I mean, if it's 3 years, discount rate doesn't really matter. But if we are talking about a system that's going to take you 5 years to produce, or a mind that it's a tunnel is going to take you 5 years to prepare for.
If it's all like share options then, I guess.
I think
in long term sense.
I think something like infrastructure, you're right, that's probably a reasonable thing, but then that's probably not really quite what you're talking about, generating great. Like if somebody's made a decision to do a tunnel, who's managing it? They're just delivering to a schedule on the budget and everything else. It's not exactly generating great entrepreneurial gains for the company that was made when the decision was made to build the tunnel.
But
if you're running a company with a series of strategies, you should have exit points and
reassessments of strategy and having something locked in a strategy for a company for 3 years these days seems an awful long time. You know, you may not you get somewhere and you I can start a new taxi company at the moment with a 3-year horizon and Uber will have blown it away by the time I got there, you know. I don't.
You raised a good point at the beginning, Anthony, around who's paying. And I noticed in my previous life in the UK, obviously with all that happened there, it's one thing just talking in the private sector, but when you've got public money in the system who are actually sitting behind these banks or financial institutions, then it's far more pointy around the level of pay, of course.
Yeah, the assessment's being done by the public, which is a problem, because I don't think there are any easy kind of long-term assessments. And then, to the extent that you can improve them, you're making it complicated and you've lost the public's kind of concentration.
Yeah.
Let's come back to that. I think, you know, Kurt's point about the question about this, do we blame the analysts? I think quite a strong point, sort of evidence in Montier's paper is this little graph about the CFO would not invest in a project that was value creative if it was going to hit the short term earnings, and the view is therefore that analyst and the great unwashed investor can't understand longer term value. Is that right? I mean, Alan, you've got some experience with analysts.
it may be that it's partly related to the fact American companies report 4 times a year. Its frequency, and that maybe to your point, Cameron, that because there's less coverage or the pool of analysts is shrinking, that they don't have enough time to devote to any one particular company. So they're very focused on what guidance the company gave for earnings this quarter. And it's pretty much did they meet or did they beat? It's all they care about.
Yeah.
It's not as bad here, but there's this great dump of information from companies twice a year in February and August. And then you spend the rest of the year trying to figure out what they actually told you.
It's very rare to see analysts really take a punt on something, though. When you look at the share price recommendation, it's normally current share price plus or minus a bit. It's very rare that they really take a position that actually the valuation currently is very over or undervalued. So, and if you move the short-term earnings, therefore, you move their advice. So I think that plays into the short-termism attitude. So I think you can definitely blame the analysts a bit.
That's true, I think. But their value is usually much more in their commentary than in their final price target. And actually, contrary to some of the things Cameron said, in my dealings with analysts, I've found them to be extremely well informed and to have a very thorough understanding of what they're talking about. And that's now, but even going back, my first dealings with analysts were a bit over 20 years ago, and even then I thought the best ones were very well informed and quite analytical in their thinking. And it's the best ones who set the tone in that particular market, because if an analyst is shallow, people will see that very quickly. So I can't believe that the analysts don't understand these issues. Of course, when they make their presentations, everything is presented in a highly simplified form, and perhaps something's lost there.
Or is it the effectiveness of the board, not sort of not representing shareholders' interests?
Is it what to the analysts, or can we
I guess what, well, I suppose we're talking towards compensation. I mean, is it that the ex-co's got it right? Is the Remco, are they actually, have they got the compensation structure right for the organisation, or are they holding the company to account on that score?
There's an argument of maybe public record keeping that ever since pay scales were actually published in the back of the annual report, nowadays, that the average pay has actually gone up. Because every other CEO is looking at what is meant to be paid.
Nobody wants a bad, cheap CFO.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. The chairman and the board, they do not want to get the cheap second-rate CEO. They want the best.
Yeah,
and you've got to pay for the best.
No, I'm a cheap actor. I'll use that argument all the time. But can I just make one quick comment? I was going to just agree with you that I actually see the problem for analysts is it's not that the analysts don't know what they're doing, but the analysts have to communicate to a population of less informed people as well. And they have to keep their message simple, and they have to keep the message that's relatively simple between Coles Myer, BHP, financial service, on some way that the average person can get it. You know, I'm on a couple of private client lists myself. You get like half a dozen analyst reports a day, and no one's going to sit there and deeply analyse it if you've got your own little portfolio. You know. Probably the place where I see most serious work done is not even the super funds, but only some of the good private equity or some fund managers who really have had long-term good performance, where they do spend a lot of time on a few stocks and hold those for a long time. But those guys will really, or girls will really understand the stocks, and they're the ones who recognise the gems.
Shining some light will be interesting, but I don't know if you, another quick thing that came up, the UK was on, they were beginning to put regulations in about gender pay, where they're going to have to put that in reports, and I think that might follow over here soon. But that is preempting that. Some of the big firms like Deloitte in the UK have just released their gender pay inequality numbers because it's more convenient or more plausible to release it voluntarily and manage the message than potentially wait till it comes out in the reports. But I think that could be interesting here, because I think it's like with time we'll look back and they'll both be gender pay in reports, but there'll also be these more interesting figures around sort of CEO to average worker pay in the organisation. And I personally believe just the more disclosure, that at least shines a bit more light and helps the debate. Because at the moment it's surmising.
I'm interested in the question of actually the impact of the analysts on the share price and on investment in the economy. It's just worth exploring it. You also got experience in investments in the fund. Opinions on this matter. Is it possible that the fact that we put a lot of money into the mines actually suggests that our investment markets are working quite well in this country?
It depends on, who you're talking about as the person investing, because, the broad universe of investors, you're sort of retail, institutional, and all the rest of it, and in terms of what's actually motivating people and over what time frames. For people that got in and got out of the right moments, particularly before you had the quite sizable collapse in commodities in the past year or so, they're looking quite handsome themselves. But in that sense, I think part of it's just acknowledging the sort of limitations of Australia as a country, in the sense that if you look at our industries, broadly speaking, mining's quite a sizable component of the resource sector in general, and banking as well. I think we passed a high point earlier in the year where at one stage our financial sector, more specifically, I think it was the big four banks made up a third of the total ASX 200 market cap, or it was some quite sizable threshold. So in that sense, it's it's an interesting one, and I think it just it reflects the nature of our country a bit more than investors' preferences, so to speak, particularly when you think about the sort of institutional investors that you have in play in Australia. If you're managing an investment fund with a passive mandate that you're just trying to follow a particular benchmark, well, in that case, you are a bit more limited in your options. And if your benchmark is saying I'm going to be a third of all of my money is going to be going to financials, in that sense, you're quite restricted because just the nature of our manufacturing base and our economy more broadly is more narrow than other countries. I mean, we're in some respects we're akin to Canada, with the one exception being their manufacturing industry, where they do have quite a sizable auto sector that's gotten slammed in recent times because of the high value of the Canadian dollar. But just going back as well to what's been said about the value that analysts bring, I think there might be something to that as well, in just the sense that I see some of these industry publications mainly more specific to general insurance and the like, and I just wonder if there is a case to give them their work a bit more publicity, because you see some of the analysis and that being done there, it's not really been replicated anywhere else. And one thing I found quite interesting last year was being presented at the Institute GI seminar, where I was talking about just the customer value proposition of major insurers and the like. And that's something that I think circulated to a broader audience than just the actuaries would actually be of interest to a lot of people. And it might be the case where if we can just have a bit more, if we can have greater proliferation of some of these more informed views, it would engender better outcomes.
I think there's a fundamental disconnect between shareholder value and maximising that and executive compensation. So when I look at it from the point of view of an investor, what drives shareholder value is a combination between the average PE ratio when you purchase the share, the equity per share that you're purchasing, the return on equity, and the payout ratio of the dividend. On the other hand, I see a lot of long-term incentive schemes that are written in terms of increase in total shareholder return over the next 12 months. That is a long-term incentive that you see in a lot of plans. There's also short-term incentives, but when they're linked to things like that, they're actually looking at maximising the dividend and looking at what the share market, Mr. Market, did with his bipolar machinations from time to time over the year. And then you bring analysts into it as well. Now, from the shareholder, what you want to happen in the company is you want it to grow. So you want the growth rate of the company to increase, because that will increase the return on equity, which will increase your value, and it should also put up the average PE over time. If you look at how the incentives within the company work, then what they're trying to do is increase the total shareholder return over that year. Now, if that means growth, that's fine, but how do they do it? Because their remuneration is linked to the total shareholder return and a bunch of other things. Do they increase the debt load of the company to go and grow in new projects and new ventures? If they do that, they're penalised in the market and the share price will come down because the analysts react negatively to increasing debt. If they reduce the dividend payout ratio so that they retain more equity to fund the growth in the company, then they're penalised for that from the analysts, because that's seen as reducing the dividend payout over the short term to the shareholder. If they issue more shares to the market, then that is seen very unfavourably by fellow shareholders, because all of a sudden your proportion of the total equity of the company has reduced somewhat, and that's not a very good thing either. but there is constant pressure on companies to increase the dividend payout ratio, which in Australia is quite high. A lot of the companies in Australia don't really keep a lot of their dividends to increase their pool of equity. So there's this constant push and pull, because if companies do risky things to try and grow, then it can not only affect the shareholder return in that year, which is what they're really focusing on, it can affect the executive's remuneration as well. So if you're an executive, are you going to really risk that much and do some of these things? And I agree with Greg that there's a lot of investment that isn't really seen as investment because it just goes through the balance through the P&L instead of on the balance sheet as well.
Speak to the billion, because the United States markets do suffer from those things. From what I've heard, in the sense that maybe the Australian market not as bad as that, but we need a little bit of research into seeing the extent to which some local research, the extent to which the notices are restrained from perhaps that's something we need to restrain in terms of. We say the others are pretty good. They need to be appear more frequently in the press. There's sort of the longer term views. Now, what about CEOs? Sam Palmasino gets a bad knock in this article for setting the IBM's target as maximizing 5-year value. But I actually give, he did a little interview in the Harvard Business Review, which I give to my students, where he basically stopped giving quarterly forecasts on the basis that that was the wrong thing to focus on, what you focus on the longer term. And his comment in the Harvard Business Review was just being, it's immaturity on the part of CEOs. They don't educate analysts. Alan, is that something you've seen? Or, do you think the CEOs, do you think when you go and speak to the CFOs and CEOs, are they educating analysts?
I think there's an element of trust as well that is gained over the long term, and it's also an element of CEO tenure, and in some companies it is very short, so therefore there is a lot of skepticism. On the other hand, if a business has been proven to grow shareholder value over the long term, the market should be willing to give management some leeway. Just like what happened with Seek, I think the CEO was in the papers complaining, saying that my share price tanked because I said I was increasing investment this year to grow over the long term, and he has undoubtedly grown shareholder value over the long term since listing. But then on the other hand, you've got Harvey Norman come out and buy a dairy farm, which is completely unrelated to his core business. So,
what was he punished for that?
Not really, no. But because he's a major shareholder, you can't really vote him out. You're stuck with him until he passes away.
But there wasn't a shareholder revolt in terms of a low share price.
I think that was more because the market fell anyway. I don't think there was an overreaction because he bought the farm with shareholder money.
So your perspective is that Australian shareholders are relatively short-sighted in their price?
I think it depends on whether they're... There are companies where you believe that they have long-term growth prospects because they're selling, they're making, they're developing something that has a huge market that potentially is much more than just the Australian market. If you're stuck here in a niche and you've got absolutely no prospects about growing, you know, small part of this economy, then it becomes much more difficult and nuanced.
I think we have to be really careful that we don't try and make all companies the same thing. I don't have a problem with a company that's a big, has a big, you know, in actuarial terms, embedded value, that just manages that embedded value carefully over time, versus a small startup, which is share price is meant to go boom, and I'm taking a punt on it. I don't want both those companies to be the same. And they shouldn't be, nor a company that's had a bit of a rough trot and you've brought in a specialist to restructure the business and bring it back as well. And I would have thought the executive remuneration for all those three are quite different beasts. Quite different beasts. And in fact, some things are completely inappropriate to go from one to the other. For example, trying to do some startup operation where you have full salary people involved in it is probably a recipe for looking out their own salary against the shareholder versus full alignment of a visible salary and a big chunk of equity and say, if you get this thing working over a 5-year period, you're going to walk out a rich person. If you've got somebody who's running a large, stable infrastructure business, well, I'm not quite sure how they're going to move the share price by a huge amount. If you want CommBank to suddenly go and invest $50 billion in dairy products and something like that, because it's a great idea. No, give me the cash. I don't want you to have it. I don't know. I'm just saying, you be careful.
The
success of capitalism is crazy.
Yes, I think one of the things that CommBank has come up with measuring this year is customer net promoter score. I think one of the years, Ralph Norris or something like that, had a fairly low customer promoter score. I think it's for business customers, where it affected his remuneration that year. So I think there are different ways that companies can come up with measuring longer term shareholder value without blaming the financials.
I'm coming back to a question you raised a while ago now, but it was to do with the analyst translation of the facts, or distillation of the facts into material to be published widely. And I've defended them to a certain extent, but this is I now want to talk about something that is probably a weakness. If you were to go to an analyst and say, we are going to invest X million, Y billion, whatever, and the payoff period to this will be, let's say, 6 years. As I said before, I think the analysts will understand it. But then comes the problem, because what he'll do next is he'll publish analyst report that says, well, earnings per share next year will be 10 cents less, let's say. That's easy. Calculate that more or less objectively. And the year after that, we'll assume another 10 cents, or still 10 cents less. And that's a bit less objective, but on fairly firm ground. But then he may be using some kind of 3-year model with a terminal value at the end of the 3 years, and he has to take a big breath before he says, and we're going to bid up the price at the end of that 3 years. I haven't ever seen an analyst model. Probably not many people get to see them, but the inference I draw from looking at a lot of their reports over time is that it's hard to move that terminal value very much. It tends to stay fairly steady, whatever's happening. And there's a kind of an assumption there that we can recognise the short term, but long term is going to revert to its mean. They may not think of it quite that way, but that's the effect. And this is, I think, what Sue was saying a moment ago. That this is what happens when you invest, and you end up, in terms of the price target at the end of all the discussion, you get marked down.
Mm.
I think there's also generally agreed terminal values in everyone's reports, so it's quite hard for an individual analyst to buck the trend.
Just an industry PE ratio is in at the end, yeah.
Exactly. So if you're an individual analyst, are you really going to push the boat out? Yeah. Probably not, even though you might actually agree with what's happening.
But it does say that there's quite a good space for actuaries in terms of communicating and so forth. It's an actual model in many respects, communicating the ways of interpreting and understanding actuaries. Well, that's interesting. Can I come back? We've actually seems to have bought in almost entirely, we've ignored almost entirely Montier's point, which is that shareholder maximisation should not be the object of an institution. He's saying that there's a social purpose to profitism. Maximizing value is a measure of whether you're meeting the purpose or not, but it is not the purpose. Do we all buy it? I mean, do other people think that Montier has a good point then?
Well, I don't know that he did anything more than assert that. That it wasn't the right thing to focus on.
I think this is one of those things you have to decide what it is you're asking companies and stock markets to do, and what it is the state wants to set the rules around. One of the classics I think of all time is the Stern report, which talked about the greatest failure of the market at any time has been getting ourselves in our problem with greenhouse gas. And I look at them and go, well, no, there's a failure of the state not to set property rights around externalities and charge a market for them. So if you don't set the rules and you have no market, market's going to work with its rules. Yeah? It's all about trading rights. So if you don't have the right rules and the right rights being traded, markets can't work. Yeah? So to my mind, there's a bit of a circularity of this sort of question is, what is it you're asking companies and stock markets to do? What's the game? And I would have thought the game you only ever ask them is within a set of rules to maximise. Because if they're not maximising, I'm not quite sure what they're doing.
Exactly. Just sort of said that they hadn't maximised the shareholder value. It didn't say that. Didn't prove to me that they should have. They were trying to, or they should have been, or that they had other objectives that they should have been voting on.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I mean. Just in terms of sort of the general trend for his paper is he making assertions and then backing them up with maybe one or two examples, if that, and then moving on to the next point. Whereas I think in the other speech by he was trying to make the point of it's really quite, in a lot of respects, it's actually a historical consequence where we've ended up, in the sense that back in the day, companies were very much on a much more risky basis, unlimited liability and the like, and then as we've shifted more towards a limited liability model and gotten stuck within that mold, that's driven a lot of where we've ended up today. But in the sense that Greg's point there, I think there is a lot to that, because the underlying assumption behind a lot of our law is that, unlike other jurisdictions, it's this premise that what isn't everything is permitted that isn't prohibited. It's very much a permissive approach. Mm. So in that sense, there is really a need that if we do identify these objectives that we think we as a society should pursue, whether it's in the environment or elsewhere, that we try and articulate those in a much more concrete fashion. And a good example of this is, and this came up in the Haldane speech as well, is the idea that companies' mission statements and what's actually enshrined in legislation has changed quite dramatically over time to one where shareholder primacy at the moment is the one that's actually enshrined, and that's one of the key underlying duties for directors when they're running a business. So in that sense, there might be, it's funny, when you think about a lot of what we've discussed today, lot of it does get back to the rules of the game that we do have around it, and not just in terms of legislation, but even what we were discussing earlier about the accounting standards and whether or not they've actually moved with the times at all to reflect the sort of businesses that we do have in place. But,
So back to the topic of executive compensation, can be a little brave and point out a slightly different view. In the paper, this article, I read a few years ago called CEO Incentives. It's not how much you pay, but how, by Michael Jensen and Kevin Murphy. So basically, they asked the question that for every $1,000 change in the company's market value, how sensitive is the pay of the CEO? And they find that on average, it's actually only about $2.59 per $1,000 of market value for the company. So if you measure it that way, the best is saying that over time, the sensitivity of the pay of the CEO has actually declined relative to the total value of the company. And that's because the direct stock ownership by the executives has declined. And basically, they advocate that you should, in order to align the incentives of the management, they should have very aggressive pay for performance structures. So in that sense, you could even argue that CEOs are underpaid for the value that they add.
You are assuming then that the CEO is responsible for the whole increase in value. And I think Greg's point is that, in fact, unfortunately CBA's gone, but for the CEO of CBA to make a significant impact on a huge portfolio with a lot of momentum is actually may well be quite difficult. Just because a captain drives a ship, or pilots a plane that's worth $50 billion, but yeah, it doesn't mean to say you pay them fraction of the money, he doesn't lose as a consequence of managing it safely. Can I come back to, so I don't know if you've got the paper, chart 11 on page 22 of Haldane's paper shows how they asked the question of which is important, ask senior executives which is important, Japan, France, Germany, US, and the UK. The two questions, whose companies are the shareholders or stakeholders? And in Japan, 90%, 95% more said it belongs to all stakeholders, only 5% to shareholders. While in the US and the UK, the argument was that 80% said it belonged to shareholders, not to all stakeholders, as in France and Germany. And then the other question they asked was, is job security or dividends more important? And in Japan, again, 95% said job security was much more important. And in Germany and France, 60% said job security was much important. But in the US and the UK, 10% said job security was most important, and dividends were more important. So, I mean, what the illustration is, which is just both backing up what Cameron has just said, that corporate law has changed dramatically in the last 30 years in the Anglosphere, to the extent that we don't believe that the responsibility of the company. The policy of the company just to maximise profits and the government to constrain job security, while in France, Germany, and Japan, high performance. So, can we imagine a situation where it changes that here? Or do we rely on government to.
You said it's changed here. Has it changed?
I don't think you would have the same answer 30 years ago.
Well, we've got 0% job security. Who were we asking?
This is. Senior executives of large companies.
I have trouble because I'm wondering what was the question asked. Let me indicate why. And I may be totally off course here, but if I imagine a nation in which job security is highly protected by the system, and now you go to a CEO within that system and you ask him how much emphasis does he put on job security, then naturally it says very little. You know, it's already done. He doesn't have to think about it. And so I don't know how to interpret those results.
I think the question, I'm sorry, I can't believe you're finding it in short notice, but I think the question was related to, do you think the company has a responsibility? Can I give you my, my little anecdote from when I first started in at the organization I went to, I had to cut out the tax. I found a way of cutting out tax twice, a reasonable amount of money. I think it was something like 60 times by the salary, so I thought that was a, this was a great idea. And I eventually persuaded this, the chief actuary, who, you know, I reported to it through five layers of things, that this was a great idea. But he was most reluctant to do it. Because his view was, the government wants a certain amount of tax for life insurance industry, we packed. We just don't fight it. And that, that was a, I mean, my father, obviously I've inherited a bit of commerciality from my father, which the chief actuary of the old region did not have, and perhaps from the university situation. I didn't understand it until 20 years later, but he had a different paradigm. It was a sort of social function that you looked up job security, paid your tax, didn't fire people, and okay, there was a mutual as well, which there was a conversation. And I think there's a
German culture is very strict around financial services. It's, you can't do. It's a, almost, it is a thing between the state and the company. It's very polarity.
So that's your experience of Germany?
Oh, I just know things like in Germany, you know, you're only allowed to have one. Now, this is old school life insurance stuff, but you're only allowed to have one bonus yet. You can't. You're not allowed to have two. So you can't just say, that product was a bad idea, we're going to shut it and start a moment. You're not allowed to do that. You've got, you start a new company, but you can't have to do that. So I know some of the things with Solvency II in Europe is that has, as you can imagine, very dramatic consequences for a company that's going to fess up to a market value balance sheet. In the current environment, that is scary stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm not an expert on Germany, but I can just understand it's got a very socialist underpinning. Same with France, it's very, they have revolutions over there every other week when somebody wants to close a factory or something. So it's, I don't understand the society, but I mean, back then you've got Japan, which is still very half feudal, very, blind by families and all that sort of stuff. It's quite murky.
At least for Germany, I think it's social and corporate structure. The unions, I think, have half the seats on the supervisory board.
That's the sort of stuff I mean.
It's no surprise that you...
Yeah, you get supervisory boards and
management boards.
Why are they so successful? They beat their own wages down to dominate the world to make sure Greece stays in the EU.
It didn't go up, right? Whereas the Spanish and Greek wages went up. So it's just catch up.
They did implement some pretty radical reforms back in the early 2000s where their wage structure did take quite a sizable change to it, and you had the creation of a lot of more low-wage jobs in recent years. So in that sense, they've altered their economy quite drastically. But in just as a broader remark, I mean, one question I was having this, this was a claim that, like what Greg's been alluding to sort of throughout, it is hard to actually illustrate in practice, but one claim that was made in one or two of these papers was this idea of a fallacy of composition. So, and a particular instance of that was making the claim that if all companies see value maximisation as a goal and in a particular aspect of that is maximising profit, one way in order to do so is to minimise your costs by pushing down labour costs was a particular instance. And if every single company's approaching this concept with that policy in mind, what sort of outcomes do you actually see in the aggregate? And so that's an interesting claim that I don't think it's actually easy to draw clear links in between the two and actually say, oh, this is the smoking gun, so to speak. I'm just wondering if anyone has used it, if not this, but any other aspects that might help explain why we have seen wages compared to what they were 20, 30 years ago, making up quite a small portion of the economic pie, so to speak.
Have you allowed for the ways of globalisation and outsourcing a lot of factory-type jobs?
I think that's a fair point.
Rich countries with high wages to poorer countries with low wages, like China is the most example, like the whole scale thing. It's just computer stuff, you know. Well, I reckon 40% of people won't have a job in 10 years' time when the robots take over.
That's always been the way.
That, to my mind, is one of the conundrums on this. It goes back to that inequality issue as well. When you, I don't know what the right word is, not democratised, but the blue-collar workers' jobs have moved. They're competing against offshore, whereas different people are just competing on maximising dollars and making decisions.
It's very interesting when you look at companies like IBM, look at the multinational, look at where their workers are, look at the growth of that business in different sectors and the employment costs. I mean, Australia is a really significantly outlier in that party when you've got super, lots of on costs, lots of other components, not just high standards of living, so or high living costs. So it is a worry. Is it sustainable here to have workers unless obviously there's a very, very high levels of knowledge economy going on that there isn't anywhere else, which there is everywhere.
So that's that you can see Australia's salaries are high relative to
And even in, I mean, let's talk at home. I mean, even if you look at as a firm we're quoted as an actuarial, let's say we're quoted some actuarial consulting work and there's various countries that we've got around the globe. I mean, our costs are very high here. Which I know is obvious to most people given what it might be to have the same resource in Indonesia or India or somewhere, but you know what I'm saying, it really is not.
Sorry, that was interesting. Has anyone else got something that they'd like to, that they have been sitting on, that they'd like to talk about?
I wonder whether what's driving the companies are the bots' understanding of why they exist. Because, yes, the CEO has their view, but they have been engaged by the board a lot of times. The mandate on certain things, and they always talk about profit. If the board is doing that, then no wonder the CEOs are doing what they're hired to do. And possibly the generational difference, I mean, as you mentioned, many years ago, people don't just talk about money. I mean, there are other moral standards that people also want to uphold. That in the later years, people may not be as interested.
I think that's a very interesting point for new hires. What we have seen is that in the past, new hires were very driven by pay. But that's certainly for younger generations now, very far, far lower amounts, far more interested in the objectives of the company, how it fits into broader society, what the long-term mission and goal of the company is, the moral role of the company.
So that's your research?
Yes. Which I think could ultimately change things a little bit more.
Okay. Last words?
All right. I was restraining myself, but the one short thing I did have to say was that on the last question you raised about basically the question is what are the obligations of a corporation, I think I'd form a voting block with Greg. I I like someone to tell me the rules, and I work within them. And I don't consider that sharp practice in any way. And if that isn't what I'm doing, then I'm confused. If you tell me here is a set of rules, but now you also have an obligation to construct your own set of rules that fulfill some other social or ethical objectives, then I'm confused. And if you tell me, well, because of these social and ethical objectives, we're going to change the rules, we're going to constrain you further, my response is fine. Go ahead and do it. And do it for everyone, and I'll be happy. I want to shirk my obligations to society, but they need to be defined.
No, I'm just going to almost totally agree. We're on the same show. No, but seriously, it's one of those things that in my personal life, I actually see myself as doing things broader for society, and I help build a company and employ people and all that sort of stuff. That's all great. But I've got a share portfolio, and I tell you what, I'm interested in maximising value out of that. I didn't ask people to give money to poor people on my behalf, or you know, go to sporting events and give out trophies. I don't care about that. It is a simple economic equation. That said, Australia as a whole, I'd like it to perform well, because when it performs well as a whole, my share portfolio is going to do well. So they're linked, but I'd go back to Greg's point, exactly right. If there's a decision at a state level that says we can get a bit of better result by mixing the way we do taxes or social overlay, that's an issue for government to set the rules. Once the rules are set, companies should just be dollars. That's my personal view. Play the rule. I voted government to get the rules right.
No, I have to agree with you guys as well. I think the world has changed, and I think just part of a lot of the discussions we've had here is we've inherited a lot of legacy structures in both the way we view a lot of these things through our current legal system and everything else. And I suppose the issue I see is, while I agree with you guys, I'm probably a bit on the pessimistic side about seeing any sort of change to actually engaging with what that social overlay is, and in terms of actually shaping it and discussing it in the near future. That's probably my most pressing concern on that point. But in any case, thanks everyone for coming along. This is quite fruitful.
I don't want to, it's unfair to get too much of a response, but I think the one issue is are we not then asking the state to do too much, particularly given the way in which the state can be held ransom by vested interests of various sorts and is influenced by various interests? And is it really right, true to say that while in my personal objectives I may have a set of objectives that are broader than just making money? Of my students, if that's what they think I'm making out of it, this review codes. To saying that the institutions should actually be structured to make money at the expense of others. And I think the argument, I would agree with entirely, I do not want the directors to be giving money away to political parties or to charities, but I do want them to be adding as much value in their business as they want. And if it takes longer for them to do it, then so be it. I want one society to encourage them to do their business as quickly as possible. If that is Debbie's response, feel free to respond now. But okay, well, thank you very much. If anyone might write this up, I'd be very grateful. Otherwise, I might try and do something over the next 3 or 4 months. But thank you very much. Have a good day.